Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, this month, magnetic nanoparticles to trap toxins in the bloodstream, how scientists are listening to individual proteins inside cells now, and hip replacements that make their own graphite lubricants. Plus, what happens to silver nanoparticles once they get into the environment?
What happens in this assay is the earthworms can actually choose which soils they go into. In the case of the nanosilver, they didn't avoid the soils at first, but rather after being exposed for some time in the soil, they actually left the soil into the control soil.
That's Paul Birch, who will be talking to us later in the program. And also with us are our Chemistry World regulars, Bibiana Campuseo, Phil Robinson and Eleanor Richards, and I'm Chris Smith.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
And up first, how chemists are turning detective. Bibi.
Okay, so determining the age of a blood stain at a crime scene is one of the greatest challenges in forensic science. And this team of researchers led by Mikhail Beresin at Washington University in St. Louis have come up with a method that seems to work. It allows them to determine the age of the blood stain and is particularly accurate within the first 7 days of the blood stain being made.
You mentioned that it's critical in forensics to do this. With present techniques that predate this one, how do they do it then?
They use optical measurements of hemoglobin degradation, which seems to be quite unreliable. So this new method seems to be fast, reproducible, concentration independent, and requires a very, very small amount of blood to actually carry out the measurements.
Sounds like good news. You better tell us how it works then.
Well, this group of researchers have developed a technique that relies on the fluorescence lifetime of tryptophan. They have been able to measure this because a new laser became available that was specifically designed to look at tryptophan, and actually it uses a wavelength of 295 nanometers.
It's a blue laser light.
Yes. So tryptophan's fluorescence is known to be very sensitive to its environment. So what happens is that the proteins, with the changes in the environment, the proteins age and degrade, and the fluorescence lifetime decreases. So they were able to measure that.
How do they standardize this? Because different environments might make the tryptophan break down more quickly. Also, how do you know roughly how much tryptophan is there? Because there will be different amounts of the amino acid in different blood samples. So how do they get a standard for it?
Well, at the moment, they only have done this in the lab. They've used blood from dogs and they've carried out the degradation in petri dishes. So they haven't seen what happens when there are organic surfaces or what happens in the presence of bacteria or anything like that. So to an extent, that is research that still needs to be carried out. In terms of the standard, we know that the method is concentration independent. And basically, because they measure the lifetime, they're not looking at the actual concentrations.
So they're looking at the lifetime of the fluorescent signal rather than its amplitude, which would be proportional to the amount.
Concentration,
so,
yes.
Yeah, so that sort of irons out that problem.
Yes, yeah.
Ingenious stuff. Well, let's stick with the blood. And Eleanor, tell us about a way of getting things out of the blood that shouldn't be there. In this case, we're talking cadmium.
Yeah, yes. Heavy metal pollution is on the rise, according to researchers Jun Jin and Jian Taima from Lanzhou University in China. And now they've developed a nanoparticle to inject into the bloodstream to pick up one of those heavy metals, cadmium, so that it can be removed just by using a magnet.
Seems ironic to inject one toxic thing, potentially, yeah, to get another one out. What's the particle they put in?
It's a nanocomposite and it's made up of four components. So the first one is magnetic iron oxide nanoparticles, and they've been chosen because of their low toxicity. And then they coated these with a polymer, polyethylenimine, which binds to cadmium. This has another function as well. It also reduces the chances of nanoparticle uptake by red blood cells, so it maximises their circulation time in the blood. And then they grafted polyethylene glycol onto this as an anchor for a negatively charged 2,2 phenyl azine diacetic acid.
Easy for you to say. What does that do?
And this counteracts interactions between the nanoparticles and either plasma proteins or white blood cells.
Oh, stopping them getting anchored onto the wrong thing.
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so that gets the particles whizzing around in circulation and chelating lots of cadmium.
Yes.
How do you get them out again?
With a magnet.
It doesn't sound too trivial, though, because these things are in your bloodstream.
Yeah.
You don't take someone to a scrapyard and put them under the dangly magnet, presumably.
No. Jin thinks that the nanocomposites would be injected into a vein to start with, and they would bind to the cadmium ions in the blood and then be removed by circulating in the blood through a magnetic field, attracting the nanocomposite cadmium ion complexes, and then the detoxified blood would then be returned to the body.
So it's a bit like when you do kidney dialysis. You could have this as an extra bit of plumbing.
Yes.
How practical is this? And how much of a problem is cadmium or other heavy metal poisoning that would really make this worthwhile?
Well, the toxic metal ions, they bind to proteins in the body and they affect the protein's function, and this can eventually lead to organ damage or possibly cancer.
Definitely a case of prevention being better than cure by the sound of it. Thanks, Eleanor. And talking of nanoparticles...
My name is Paul Birch. I work in the area of environmental chemistry and toxicology. I'm a professor at the University of Kentucky. Over the past decade, there's been an explosion in the manufacturing as well as use of nanotechnology in many, many products that are used regularly. And one of the emerging issues is what are the potential environmental implications of nanomaterials being released from these products into the environment? Are they taken up by organisms in the environment? And can they be transferred through the food chain with the potential exposure to humans as well?
This is a question of, we've learned our lesson from things like asbestos. We don't want to repeat.
Yeah, that's correct. Asbestos, or you may even think of pesticides like DDT or even mercury that's anthropogenically released typically from coal fire plants.
I mean, this sort of idea about nanohazardicity has been knocking around for a little while, though, hasn't it? At least 5 years, people have been saying there is this risk. But what are people actually doing about it? And what's the objective evidence that there may actually really be a problem?
The picture is still not totally clear yet. What we're trying to do as a community of scientists coming at this from a variety of different angles is to, again, understand what properties of the nanomaterials as manufactured, as well as what properties as transformed once they're released to the environment or taken up by a biological organism, are critical relative to toxic effects to those organisms.
So tell us about your worms then.
So our earthworm studies have been conducted actually in soil. So the nanomaterials are added to soil and the earthworms are allowed to be raised in that soil for 28 days, and we look at accumulation of nanomaterials in the tissues, as well as any effects based on things like lethality, so toxicity in terms of lethality, reproduction, and also behavior. And what we found was that the silver nanomaterials, for example, were far less toxic than dissolved silver, orders of magnitude less toxic in terms of lethality and reproduction. What we also discovered, however, that was quite a surprise is in terms of behavior, and this is measured by the earthworm's ability to avoid soils containing nanomaterials. The earthworms were sensing these nanomaterials at quite low concentration levels and levels that could not be explained by the release of dissolved silver.
How do you know they were sensing them?
So it is known that earthworms, for example, will avoid soil at low pH and having metal contamination and even some organic contaminants. And so what happens in this assay is the earthworms can actually choose which soils they go into. And in 100% of the cases, soils contaminated with dissolved silver, that is the silver ion, they avoided them in all instances. And then in the case of the nanosilver, at first, they didn't avoid the soils at first, but rather after being exposed for some time in the soil, they actually left the soil into the control soil. And so we assume that what's happening there is that they're sensing either the particles or the particles are interacting with their cuticle and releasing dissolved ions, for example, that they then sense.
Now, how long do we think these things might hang around for? Because if you look at the DDT story, or even the asbestos on my garage roof, the evidence is these things hang around for a very long time in the environment. So do we think that things like nanoparticles of silver are going to have a similar longevity effect?
Well, in the case of silver, it's a little bit more complicated because they transform chemically. A sulfide and the transformation of silver metal nanomaterials to silver sulfide nanomaterials is actually quite rapid under a wide range of environmental conditions. Certainly in wastewater treatment process, this appears to be a very important reaction that occurs rapidly, and the silver sulfide particles then appear to be stable. And because of the very low solubility of these silver sulfide phases, it could be that they would remain stable for very long periods of time. But one of the complexities in this whole area is that the manufactured materials are manufactured in many different ways. And so not only is size an issue as we get into nanoscale, but we have things, other different properties of these nanomaterials, such as shape, the actual crystalline form, as well as what types of surface functional groups are put on during the manufacturing. So depending on what the coating is, the nature of the coating, and how that coating interacts once that particle is put into an environmental matrix, you know, all these factors are very complicating in terms of trying to be able to predict what will happen in terms of longer-term reactivity. These particles presumably could be stable for quite some time.
What should we be doing to make sure that we mitigate this risk, or at least we're in a position to identify what the threats are to control them before we just massively upscale the production of these things, because we can see lots of tangible benefits to industry and society and so on, and there might actually be a lot of dirt being swept under the carpet with this?
The benefits of nanotechnology are clear, and I think where we really need to take the research effort is take the collective evidence that has been generated thus far and begin to piece together a picture of what properties of nanomaterials actually make them less bioavailable, less toxic, and less benign, and kind of think about a research effort that's focusing on the safe design of nanomaterials.
Paul Birch from the University of Kentucky. And now to something slightly larger than a nanoparticle, but with huge potential to be destructive. Eleanor, tell us more.
Well, termites are a big problem in Australia, and they cause an estimated $2 billion of damage to buildings. So, Australian researchers, led by Zhang Qiao at the University of Queensland, are looking at more effective ways of killing them than what's currently on the market.
I know, I remember being gobsmacked when I went to see a friend of mine in Perth, and I couldn't understand why they had a metal fence, because this seemed like an extraordinarily expensive way to enclose your garden. And they said because the half-life of a wooden fence in this bit of Australia would be measured in milliseconds, because the termites would just come along and eat it. So I can understand the scale of the problem. Mm-hmm. So what are they doing instead then?
The conventional solution is to use agrochemical biocides like DDTs, dichlorodiphenyl trichloroethane, and they've been using wooden stakes surrounding a property and putting their biocide onto the stakes. Then the termites come along, chomping away at everything that's wooden.
So
that's
it
in
says
their
like
way.
These are stakes, as in wooden bait for termites,
yes.
Like termite food, but impregnated with nasty things.
Yes. So they would come along and they would chomp on these and then die.
Yeah.
But the problem with that is you're only killing a handful. What you need.
And there's also the environmental impact that you've got, the chemicals that are on there leaching out everywhere.
I mean, they could bioaccumulate, which means they go up the food chain, and of course that would affect.
And because predators. You're not targeting it just at the termites, the dose that you have to put into those lures would probably be quite high.
I would imagine so, yeah. So what they've done instead is they're putting the biocides directly into the colonies by putting them inside silica nanoparticles with loads of tiny pores. And the particles release the biocide in a controlled manner. So it takes about 48 hours at the moment for this biocide to leak out. And this means that the termites that get onto the biocide, they get affected by that, but then they move further into the colony and spread the biocide around, killing a lot more.
What sort of trials have they done to prove this can work?
They have done a small trial, a small test on a group of termites, and it did work. They monitored over 48 hours, and in 24 hours it had killed all of the termites. This isn't ideal because that's killing them too quickly. They want the slow-release mechanism to spread throughout the entire colony.
The stuff that they are using, is there an environmental risk with this, or is it better?
This is better because it goes directly into the colony, so it's less likely to be picked up perhaps by predators.
Well, let's get really small now. Phil, tell us about the nano ear. I'm intrigued to hear about this one. What's going on?
Yeah, the nano ear, Chris. You and I know that in our macro-scale world that we live in, it's full of the sounds of machinery. And very often, the sounds of these machines will tell us something about the operation of those machines. I certainly know my bike chain at the moment probably needs a bit of looking at.
It's engine it's on my car.
Yeah, well, precisely, precisely. Similar to that, at the micro scale, we also have machinery. We have proteins in cells, and a lot of chemists spend a lot of time building little molecular machines as well. So just as the machines in our macro scale world will make noises, so too do these micro scale machines produce acoustic vibrations. But of course, we can't listen to those. So what we
because
have here,
they're too small.
Because they're too small. Yes, exactly, exactly. The energy of these vibrations is far too tiny for us to be able to listen to. Our ears simply are not sensitive enough.
So how could we pick them up?
Well, that's the problem that Jochen Feldmann has taken a look at. He's works at the Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich, and along with his team, they had an idea that they could use optical tweezers to do this. So optical tweezers are a means of confining very small objects using a laser beam. What Jochen proposed was that by looking at the motion of a particle that's trapped in optical tweezers, we should be able to tell something about the environment that it's in.
Because it will pick up the vibrations from that environment.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, he puts it very nicely himself. He likens it to an apple hanging on a tree branch. If the apple is being moved by the wind, by looking at how the apple responds to the wind, well, that will tell you something about the wind itself.
But what about the fact that it might be hanging on a very big, stiff, thick branch that doesn't move very much, or it might be hanging on a twig and will therefore move in a different way? How can you discern those two? Because in the context of a cell, there'll be vibrations from all these molecular motors. Some of them are going to be tiny, some are going to be bigger. How do you distinguish?
This is a proof of concept. They haven't used it to listen to cellular processes. All they have shown so far is that they can listen to a single sound source.
But so you're watching the nanoparticle vibrating because it's picking up the vibrations from whatever the source is, and you can infer what the movement of that source must be based on what the nanoparticle does.
You're quite right, you're quite right. So they literally look at the nanoparticle and they look at the way that it moves under the influence of the sound vibrations. Of course, it moves all the time anyway, even without the sound vibrations, just due to normal Brownian motion. So what they have to do is to disentangle that motion from the motion caused by the sound wave, which they manage to do very effectively. They measure a number of sound waves and show that the particle is capable of hearing these different waves. But again, they have not actually used it to listen to a cell, and as you've pointed out, there are a number of other considerations that might make it difficult to do that. You have sensitivity issues, for one thing, the size of the nanoparticle, and exactly how confined it is, the strength of the branch, as you put it, will all affect how effective this tool would be.
I'm still blown away by the prospect of what you could do, though. I mean, it sounds extraordinary, but is it likely to be practically useful?
Well, there are at least a couple of people who think so. Some experts that I talked to when I was looking at this story, they said that the possibility of listening to cellular machinery is indeed feasible. Of course, it depends upon, again, how energetic these noises are. Can they be heard above the normal Brownian noise? But it's certainly a possibility.
Phil Robinson. You're listening to Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, have scientists stumbled upon the ancestor of RNA that might have helped to kickstart life? Before that, you know that greaseproof paper that your lunch comes wrapped in? The stuff you throw in the bin and you don't eat? Yes, that. Well, the chances are you're probably eating and metabolising a whole lot more of the fluorine-rich material in there than you might think. Scott Mabry.
For a good 15 years or so, we were been interested in generally the role of fluorine in influencing environmental fate of chemicals, both, you know, human-derived and naturally-derived. Related to that is, why are humans so contaminated with perfluorinated acids, These are carboxylic acids that have a chain of carbon and fluorine bonds. They're very persistent. We don't know any means by which Mother Nature has to degrade them, so they do stick around for a long time. Humans have relatively high concentrations in the parts per billion in our blood of these perfluorinated acids, both carboxylic acids and sulfonic acids, sometimes called PFOA or PFOS. We've made a number of discoveries of other fluorinated compounds, some of which are actually compounds of in commerce, commonly used chemicals that humans are routinely exposed to, including these PAPs. These are perfluorinated alkyl phosphates or phosphinates. They're food contact paper chemicals. Industry puts them on paper to impart wonderful properties of both water and oil repellency. Originally, the assumption was that these compounds stayed on the paper, and if they didn't stay on the paper, they weren't really bioavailable, and if they were bioavailable, they wouldn't stick around very long. It turns out when we actually looked and developed the methods in human blood, we can routinely find these PAPs and PAPs-related kinds of chemicals of commerce in human blood at fairly high concentrations. And
so the big question is, it's one thing to find them. It's another to actually say, well, are they safe or are they a risk?
The connection we're trying to ask is, do the perfluorinated acids found in human blood, are they to some degree a result of and a product of the metabolic conversion of these PAPs chemicals? And it was a bit of a surprise to us that we found PAPs in human blood samples of fairly high concentrations despite the fact that they're fairly quickly removed. So that suggests a consistent and ongoing source of exposure. Our results in rat studies and in correlation in looking at human blood samples do suggest that a significant proportion of the perfluorinated acids themselves are actually produced in situ in humans through metabolic processes, converting these PAPs chemicals into the perfluorinated acids.
So they're not the metabolically inert things that we thought they were. They do actually engage in metabolic pathways. They are further modified.
Well, the perfluorinated acids themselves do not, but they're the result of metabolic transformations of chemicals that we never would have thought would have been in human blood in the first place.
So what are you finding when you follow these things up? What's the outcome?
Well, the thing we're interested in is actually the PAPs in and of themselves are phosphate esters. The metabolism of that in and of itself is not super interesting, but it's actually the products of that on the way to the perfluorinated acids that we are very interested in. These intermediates, we have tested some of them, their toxicity against Daphnia magna, the common water flea, often viewed as the canary of surface waters, and found them to be really quite toxic and quite biologically hazardous.
In what way are they dangerous?
Their intrinsic reactivity is electrophiles and reacting with hopefully glutathione. That's a common chemical in mammalian systems that protects us from reactive electrophilic chemicals. So it's a protection mechanism. But if glutathione isn't around, then other things could react. Then you have the potential for disruption of protein, enzymatic, or cellular function.
So given the ubiquity of these things and what you're finding in terms of what they might be able to do in the body, what is the implication given the huge burden of these things that are out there in the environment? Is there anything we can actually do about it?
Well, the use on food contact paper, as a consumer chemical, we can move to alternatives. With a surface that's not going to leach small molecules into the food that then, of course, have a route to human exposure by which we metabolize them into reactive intermediates.
But what about the fact that there's already, from what you're saying, a huge burden of these materials out there in the environment?
There is a large burden of the ultimate degradation products, the perfluorinated acids. The lifetime in humans are, depending on which one we talk about, on the order of 4 or more years. So it takes quite a bit of time to flush the ultimate degradation products out of our system. If we could shut off the front end on exposure to, these small fluorinated surfactants like PAPs, then the concentrations in humans' blood would fall rather dramatically because we metabolize them on the order of days.
But what if it's in the environment? If you've got, say, a fish, which are picking it up from ocean sources, and it's going to accumulate in fish or other carnivores, and we then consume them, are we not going to bring this back into our bodies, perhaps in a further onward metabolized way that may have other consequences?
We certainly will bring, and will continue to bring, probably for a long, long time, the ultimate these perfluorinated acids, what I refer to as the ultimate degradation products, because there is a large burden in the environment, not only of the acids themselves, but actually, I think more importantly, the precursors to those acids. Once the perfluorinated acids get into the ocean, I see no even science fiction way of going in there and removing them. Mother Nature has not proven, at least in any studies that I've seen, able to degrade these molecules on any kind of time scale that is measurable. And so that's problematic. There are lots of natural compounds that are also produced that are very long, persistent too, but human contribution to that on the global scale is probably quite significant. I think we can do a lot proactively going forward to to be smarter and not further contribute. But I'm certainly not creative enough so far to think about how to clean up the environment in that regard.
So you really are what you eat, including perfluorinated hydrocarbons. That was Scott Mabry from the University of Toronto. Time to get hip now. Bibi.
I'm going to be talking about metal-on-metal hip replacements. This is a really interesting piece of research, actually. People knew that, metal-on-metal hip replacements are becoming very, very popular because of their low wear compared to other types of hip replacements. But very little was known about precisely the sliding between the metal parts of the replacement.
So we know they're better. We know that they work and they produce less of this wear debris, which is inflammatory and bad for patients, that you get with plastic. But we don't know why they're good.
Yes,
or why they work, at least.
Yes, until now, this group of researchers, there's two researchers involved in this work. One is Lawrence Marks from Northwestern University in the US, and the other person is Alphonse Fischer from the University of Duisburg-Essen in Germany. So both started looking at metal-on-metal hip replacements, and actually they discovered that on the tribological layer, which is the layer that affects the friction, lubrication and wear of the two surfaces, there is evidence.
So where
of,
they touch, for want of a better term.
yes, where they touch, exactly. There is evidence of graphite.
Graphite? Carbon? Where does that come from? So is that from the metal?
No, it's not from the metal. It is a very interesting result. The metal replacement uses an alloy of cobalt, about 60% of cobalt, about 26% of chromium, and between 5 and 7% of molybdenum. So what these researchers suggest happens is that the albumin from the synovial fluid is reduced to carbon by the metal, and then the sliding between the joints converts the carbon to graphite.
Wow. So actually you're making and reducing amino acids back to carbon in these joints. That's incredible. Does the chemistry stack up, though? Because there's more to an amino acid than just carbon, of course.
Yeah, this is what they have seen happens in the lab. But critics of their research have wondered what happens to the nitrogen,
because
there should be some nitrogen there. But if you read the paper, there is no evidence of nitrogen. So I think there's a lot of work to come. But it's a really interesting result. And who would have thought that you could find graphite in hip replacements? And one wonders as well that while you can improve the performance by perhaps making the replacement so that it can generate more of this graphite, because it's obviously a good lubricant.
So the graphite coats the rubbing surfaces of the metal replacements and forms a layer which does lubricate the contact points.
Yeah, which actually makes it low wear. So potentially you could improve the performance by generating more graphite.
But it's amazing that you make your own lubricant in these things, isn't it?
Yes.
Incredible.
The issue, though, is the physiological effects of having all this graphite in your body.
Are there thought to be any?
Yes, because it flakes off. So we'll have to see what happens with that.
That's still an amazing story, Bibi. Thank you very much. Well, let's go to another amazing story, the possibility that scientists have got a bit closer to theorising about how life got started in the first place. Phil.
Yes. Well, where we come from is a topic that has intrigued scientists for a long, long time. We all know that life, our life, is based upon DNA. And the idea that the origins of life came from RNA has been one that's been around for quite some time, the RNA world hypothesis.
RNA being the single-stranded relative of DNA.
The only difference between them being the small structural change in the molecules themselves, DNA being deoxyribonucleic acid and RNA being ribonucleic acid.
So what's wrong with the idea that RNA started the process and we just manipulated it, modified it a bit and used DNA instead, and that was a later change? What's wrong with RNA as the precursor?
There's nothing essentially wrong with RNA, but it's reasonable to assume that the early chemical reactions that produced RNA would also have produced relatives of RNA, and in fact there may have been other molecules that were precursors to RNA.
And they've been supplanted by RNA subsequently because RNA has some other advantage or is slightly better than they would have been.
Exactly, exactly.
Is there any evidence for such molecules ever existing?
Well, one such molecule that has been proposed as a possible precursor to RNA is TNA. So that's threose nucleic acid. And this one is reasonably appealing because it's actually simpler than RNA. Obviously, if you're starting with the origins of life, it's reasonable to assume that you have the simplest possible molecules. So threose is simpler than RNA. It's one carbon shorter. And again, early chemical reactions probably would have produced TNA at the same time. So it's reasonable to assume, or at least propose, that TNA might have been around first.
So who's working on this? Who is suggesting this?
Well, this work has been done by John Chaput, and he works at the Arizona State University.
So what's he saying?
Well, he's certainly not saying TNA came first, although many people are saying that. All he's set out to do is to say, can TNA behave like RNA? That's what he's tried to do. So what he's done is tested to see whether or not they can evolve TNA to have a function. So RNA, one of its most important roles is the fact that it can form into complex structures. It can have a tertiary structure that allows it to then bind to other molecules, proteins, for example, and catalyse reactions. Thereby, we have life. What hasn't been shown up to now is that TNA can behave like that. So Chaput has shown that TNA can do that. They've taken a large selection of effectively random TNA sequences and they've combined it with a protein called thrombin, and they've tried to evolve the binding of TNA to thrombin in vitro. So they've effectively forced the evolution of the TNA sequences, selecting only those ones that bind to the thrombin. And they've successfully shown that, in fact, the TNA does behave in that way. So they've added some weight to the argument that perhaps TNA came before RNA.
Now, don't go away, Phil, because I have to wish you Happy New Year. Not Happy New Year in the normal sense, but in the Chinese sense.
That's right, that's right. So very recently we had the Chinese New Year. And also, subject very close to my own heart, we also had Burns Night. So I've decided to combine the two of these things in this month's trivia. We all know that the Chinese gave us fireworks, but can you tell me, Chris, which one of the following three very Scottish things the Chinese also gave us? Porridge, whiskey, or the bagpipes?
I can't believe the bagpipes came from anywhere other than Scotland. Only the best whiskey comes from Scotland, and I'm being terribly sycophantic because I don't want you to devolve. I don't want you to leave the United Kingdom. And I'd have to go, therefore, for porridge. I reckon the Chinese were into their porridge.
Well, and in fact, you're spot on there, Chris, but it was a bit of a trick question because had you answered whiskey or bagpipes, you would also have been correct.
Really?
And that is, in fact, the case.
So the Chinese invented bagpipes?
Basically, it looks like the Chinese invented the Scottish.
The Chinese export most of what we use these days anyway, so I'm not really surprised
They've been at it for years, everything
that we are basically using today. That's
maybe
quite
intriguing.
Maybe
if we do devolve, we can ask to join the Chinese again.
Well, you've got no choice, mate.
Phil Robinson, Chemistry World commentator from the Chinese state of Scotland. That's it for this month. Thank you to our contributors, Paul Birch and Scott Mabry, and to the Chemistry World team, Eleanor Richards, Phil Robinson and Bibiana Campuseo. Don't forget to check out our sister podcast in the meantime, Chemistry in Its Element, all the intrigue of the compounds that make life exciting. You can find that on iTunes or via the chemistryworld.org website. The production this month was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.